trees can't move as fast as climate changes. So to give them a head start here, that's what we're going to try to do.
Designing forests for a warming world. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
So here's this population that never gets studied, responding dramatically at high rates very, very quickly.
We wanted to actually measure exactly what was going on in the lake.
Brains are complex systems of connections,
no
modulated by connections.
You are the only person in history of mankind.
And he used Lego mindstorms to build something called a
dead constantly refreshing the screen, looking at
it. There's a chemical on something to make it scary out of it.
Dr. Harris, room 9 now, please.
On today's show, a blood test for concussions, a hospital CEO pushing his staff to think big, very big, and the promise of precision medicine. But first, 2014 has been named the hottest year on record. And during his State of the Union speech, President Obama made a passionate plea for the need to address climate change. But some fields are beginning to see adapting to climate change as a more practical approach. Philadelphia's park managers are working to keep the city's 5,600 acres of trees alive as temperatures rise, and they're bumping up against a conservation controversy along the way. Carolyn Beeler has this story.
Philadelphia's forests are big enough to fill Center City four times. For many years, forest managers have tried to make those forests, from Fairmount Park to Pennypack, look more like they did before industrialization.
We have always tried to recreate the forests of the past.
That's Joan Blaustein, head of urban forestry at the Philadelphia Parks Department.
Bring back the species and the density of early 20th century forests, which meant planting certain species and removing certain species that weren't native at that particular time.
This restoration paradigm has always governed the field of conservation biology, but today it's changing.
We know that things are going to get warmer and wetter much more quickly than ecosystems have been able to adapt to those changes ever before. We need to anticipate what the conditions are going to be 100 years from now rather than trying to restore to 100 years ago.
That's what brought me and Blaustein to Cobbs Creek Park in West Philadelphia. It's the site of one of three 30-acre test plots in the city where Blaustein's team is designing a forest for a warming world. We walk to the test plot down a muddy path rutted by heavy machinery and flanked by downed trees.
We're in the clearing phase, which means we're going to take down trees that are either dead or hazardous and remove all the invasive vines and other growth so that we can then replant with things that we want to encourage.
There's a crew cutting down trees to our right to make room for new species.
We're going to be experimenting with some more southern species.
The city will plant southern chestnut oak and bald cypress, native to warmer climates, not Pennsylvania.
And some species that are more native here but are just at the northern end of their range.
Like the southern red oak and red mulberry. These new trees will be planted in the fall, but for now, the activity is all around what's being cleared and what's being saved by Blaustein's crews.
Hey, Kurt, it's Joan. How you doing? Where are you guys?
Farther along the path, we find a second work crew removing an invasive plant called Devil's Walking Stick. But Natural Lands Restoration Manager Tom Whitmer says they're leaving a stand of yellow buckeyes, which normally they would have chopped down.
We decided for this site to actually protect pockets of them to see, okay, how does this behave? How does it survive? Does it reproduce? Does it become problematic? So it gives us a chance to really look at it in a more controlled way.
The idea is that the buckeye and those newly planted southern species might survive and take the place of native trees that die in warming temperatures. Here, sugar maple, hemlock, and basswood are some trees that are at risk. This approach, though, it's controversial.
Well, I don't know about public opinion, but there's a huge divide among conservation biologists.
That's Daniel Simberloff, an outspoken critic of the kinds of management strategies Philadelphia is testing. He says non-native species could die quickly, or the opposite, spread like wildfire and choke out other species. Also, he argues transplanting species may just be useless.
I'm far from convinced that species won't get there on their own as climate changes through normal seed dispersal.
In national parks, think Yellowstone and Yosemite, forest managers are also planning for climate change, but with a lighter touch. That's according to Nicholas Fisichelli, an ecologist with the Park System's Climate Change Response Group.
Some intensive management interventions that are appropriate on some lands may not be appropriate on park lands, where protection and conservation are the primary goals.
They are focusing on making forests healthier overall.
So for parks, reducing non-climate stressors, that includes non-native species such as tree pests and diseases and plants. And the idea here is that you reduce these non-climate stressors so that native species are better able to adapt to shifting conditions.
Somewhere between Philadelphia's tree experiments and the more hands-off national park strategy sits Chicago's management plan. The City Park District's Kathy Breitenbach says they're planting lots of different types of trees, so most of them will survive no matter what so-called global weirding does to the city.
We don't really know what may happen. We're expecting more extreme heat in the summer, but also perhaps cold in the winter. And by diversifying, we have a better chance that we won't lose large numbers of trees, whatever may happen.
Breitenbach says prairie grasses are changing too.
We've changed the specs for when we do seeding in the natural areas so that we will only accept seed from where we are or to the south. We will no longer accept any seed from areas north of us.
There's not much on the ground evidence that the strategies Joan Blaustein is trying in Philadelphia will work. But that's why it's an experiment, she says. And she thinks trying something different is better than sticking with the status quo.
We can't have a pristine mix of only historical species because there are a lot of species that are going to do very well in the future, and we can't just clear cut them away because they don't belong here. They do important work, and we need to accept that fact and not fight it anymore.
Tomorrow, even more than today, Blaustein says, we'll need trees to sequester carbon, prevent erosion, and regulate temperature.
Our ability as a species to survive are going to depend on the work that these forests do.
In 5 years, Blaustein hopes the early results of her experimental test plots will give her an idea of which new trees to plant citywide. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Maybe you were playing a drinking game during the State of the Union address, taking a swig every time you heard the words middle class, but your ears probably did perk up when President Obama said this.
So tonight I'm launching a new precision medicine initiative to bring us closer to curing diseases like cancer and diabetes, and to give all of us access to the personalized information we need to keep ourselves and our families healthier. We can do this.
This actually got some rare bipartisan applause, and it sure sounded good, but what exactly does it mean? Joining us now is David Roth. He heads the Center for Personalized Diagnostics at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
David, what exactly is precision medicine? We used to call this personalized medicine, right?
We did, but and physicians have been trying to make accurate diagnoses for centuries. When we called it personalized medicine, there was kind of a backlash from physicians saying all of our medicine is personalized, and they do have a point. I think the precision medicine term is a little more apt because it's all about careful, accurate diagnoses. If we can make accurate, or even I could make up a word, hyper-accurate diagnoses, we can treat patients much more effectively in a more timely fashion.
But what exactly does it mean when we talk about a disease, for example, like cancer? Describe what we're doing now and how precision medicine would change that.
So 3 years ago when I came to Penn, we set out to build this center. And the mission of the center was to develop diagnostic tests for cancer using techniques developed during the Human Genome Sequencing Project. The goal was to help fight the patient's cancer. And so I'm going to use a military analogy here, if that's appropriate.
Sure.
So in World War II, you had a high-value target. One of the ways to go after it would be carpet bombing. That was a lengthy process and lots of collateral damage. And now we use smart bombs, right? So you get the GPS coordinates of the target. You send your bomb, hits the target, boom. You know, very little collateral damage, and generally you get the job done.
So
It sounds to me you look at a patient and you don't say, this patient has, for example, lung cancer or breast cancer. You say, this patient has his personalized version of this cancer, and we need to address it in a way that works for exactly what ails this person.
That's exactly right. I mean, lung cancer isn't one entity. Lung cancer is many entities, and we need to be able to figure out sort of which type of lung cancer is present in this individual patient and then go after it with a particular targeted therapy.
It sounds like it could cut down on a lot of trial and error.
That is one of the main points of precision medicine, is to cut down on trial and error. Don't use an expensive drug after expensive drug and have failure after failure until you finally hit the right drug.
Sounds great, all of it so far. What are some of the big challenges that you're facing?
Well, another aspect of precision medicine is big data, and being able to harness all the data streams from radiology imaging, from pathology lab medicine, from wearable devices that monitor various things about your health. We need to be able to integrate all these data. We need to be able to integrate all the data from the electronic medical record. This is a huge challenge.
What about cost?
So getting all these data streams together is going to cost money, and I would hope that one of the results of President Obama's program would be to help fund efforts to bring the data streams together.
Where are we, in your opinion, on the trajectory? Is this field just starting, almost there?
I think we're pretty near the beginning. And so a substantial investment by the federal government would move us along quickly. We have a lot of the tools that we need. We have a reasonably good idea of where we want to go, and now we just need to have the funding to get there.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
David Roth heads the Center for Personalized Diagnostics at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up on The Pulse, pushing doctors to be creative and invent rather than working on their next research paper.
You do need to have a culture shift, and you have to be able to have the opportunity to let crazy ideas fly.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. Independence is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Doctors have a long history of inventing stuff, from stomach pumps to artificial kidneys. And one Philadelphia hospital wants to feed and grow that innovative spirit. Nestled between a hoagie shop and an Italian restaurant on South 10th Street, a former drab administrative building is now an eye-catching structure. Its exterior is trimmed in dark steel with a glass kite window curiously bulging from the second floor. This modern space is the new home of Thomas Jefferson University's Accelerator Zone. Reporter Todd Bookman caught up with Steve Klasko. He's president and CEO of the hospital, to learn more about the building and what's happening inside.
Right. What we wanted to do was basically create a double take, not create something that says, you know, like, what's wrong with this picture on Sesame Street? You know, so if people are in a rush, they'll just walk by. But I've actually watched people that walk by and then they'll like stop. Oh, that's really cool.
On my way to meet Klasko, I did walk right by without noticing the kite. You've got to glance up. But he's right. The origami-like bay window is a bright spot on this otherwise humdrum street. The shape is a less than subtle reference to Benjamin Franklin. His kite experiments with electricity, which are believed to have taken place a few blocks over, represent the curiosity Jefferson hopes to harness with its new accelerator zone. The interior also shakes off traditional hospital decor. Bright furniture, including a lime green couch, are reminiscent of a Miami hotel lobby.
I'm a Florida guy, so and I've been there, and I've been to South Beach, and I like it. But that wasn't the point. The point was there's a place that you can go and create. There are no closed spaces.
There's flat screens and smart boards and a fridge stocked with yogurt. Clasco wants staff members, residents, and medical students to feel like they're part of a slick Silicon Valley startup. The Jazz, as they've taken to calling it, is a dedicated place where teams and tinkerers can meet and work. It's also a signal that innovation and even commercial success are now just as important at the 190-year-old Jefferson as quality in the classroom and surgical suite always have been. You come up with a million-dollar idea, Clasco, a fast-talking 60-something in glasses, wants to help give it legs.
So what often happens is people leave universities when that happens. We don't want them to leave Jefferson. In fact, we want them to come from other universities here because you're going to be able to totally advance based on entrepreneurship and innovation.
Advancement through entrepreneurship and innovation. That may not sound all that groundbreaking, but it isn't the standard model at med schools, where getting published in academic journals is the traditional stepping stone to promotion. Clasco believes a new patent, copyright, or app should be just as valuable. And he hopes the Jazz, which costs $775,000 to build, inspires staff to take risks, to use the other side of their brain, even if there's growing pains along the way.
I think it's frankly BS when you get these entrepreneurs with $1 billion say, oh, I had more fun and I learned more of my failures. I think that sounds good and you almost have to say it. I've done a couple startup companies. One failed, one succeeded. I did not have fun in the one that failed.
Jazz hasn't had any failures or successes just yet. The space only opened up this month. In fact, crews are still installing the blinds on the second floor. Well, trying to. The commotion doesn't seem to bother a hushed meeting taking place inside a glass-walled conference room. One of Jefferson's doctors, I'm told, is pitching an idea to a dark-suited executive. Chief Strategy Officer John Icarius won't reveal much other than the proposal has to do with attracting wealthy Chinese medical tourists to the hospital.
The innovation ecosystem is not solely about inventing a medical device or an IT platform for your cell phone, or a new compound or drug. It could be, how do we bring more people to the city of Philadelphia? How do we bring more patients to Jefferson? That's what the innovation zone is all about.
Similar zones are popping up at hospitals around the country, and more facilities are hiring innovation-dedicated staff. But Janice Orlowski says it can't be just a building. It's got to represent a new way of doing business. She's chief healthcare officer at the Association of American Medical Colleges.
You do need to have a culture shift, and you have to be able to have the opportunity to let crazy ideas fly.
She says in 10, maybe 15 years, everyone is going to have what Jefferson is launching today.
Are the CEOs of academic health centers and deans of medical schools talking about this? Yes, they are. It's a hot topic right now. And I think that you're going to see more.
Steve Clasco told me his goal is more baby jazzes around campus, little spaces carved out to remind staff and students wherever they are that the school wants them to think big, Ben Franklin big, and is willing to grant them the time, support, and couches to do it in style. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. This month, two students at Burlington Township High School in New Jersey took their own lives. Almost 5,000 Americans between the ages of 10 and 24 die by suicide each year. Schools could be part of a first line of defense in preventing suicide, and legislators are starting to pay attention to this. Here's one example. Starting in September, Pennsylvania teachers will have to be trained in recognizing the signs of suicide risk, but
Is that enough? Joining us now are Jonathan Singer, a Temple professor of social work, and psychologist Terry Urbacher. Together, they've just written a new book called Suicide in Schools. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Jonathan, let's start with you. Does this topic come up as part of the curriculum? It's one thing to be trained to recognize warning signs, but is there a conversation about this issue that happens in classrooms?
I don't think schools are very interested in talking about suicide. I think they'd much rather not talk about it. It's a scary topic. A lot of mental health professionals are scared to talk about it, let alone, you know, the person that's teaching health class or that's trained in teaching math. The expectation that they should be comfortable talking with kids about something like suicide, it's unreasonable. And yet, it should happen.
Ideally, Terry, what should schools do?
Yeah, I think it's everything from prevention to postvention. So in prevention, you know, having a good prevention program, working with all kids in terms of just starting with emotional wellness, and then training all the students, too, in terms of looking out for your peers for any of those warning signs, training the teachers on the warning signs so that they can let the mental health professionals know there's a concern, and we can take it from there and do the screenings. And then, you know, working with the child from there, you know, monitoring that suicide risk over time, because even if we do hospitalize a student, a mistake that's often made is they return from the hospital and we think, okay, I did what I had to do. Which that's only the beginning. So continuing to monitor them and work with them over time. And then, heaven forbid, there is a suicide loss. Having a really good postvention program in place already.
So, Jonathan, postvention obviously addresses the time after something terrible has happened. It's usually not a time when everybody is thinking at their best.
No, and that's one of the reasons why having a crisis plan in place is so important. If you have a school that says, oh no, we just had a suicide death, how do we deal with it? It's almost too late.
What is the right thing to do? A lot of times everybody's worried about copycats, for example.
So there's messaging, right? So what do you say when a kid has died? This is something that has to have a personal connection. You want to make sure that there are folks available that can talk to anyone who is in emotional distress or can recognize people who might be in emotional distress.
Making sure that we don't glorify it in any way. So a lot of times kids will want to decorate lockers. Kids will want to, you know, have candlelight vigils that are not supervised. You know, really just making sure it's not glorified, because that's when you can lead to the contagion. So really also using that as an opportunity to educate kids. You know, look around you. Look at your peers. Here's what you can do if you see someone else who's feeling the distress.
How are schools doing with this kind of having a postvention team in place, having a crisis plan?
I mean, they're not doing great. The crisis teams that have been established, they tend to focus on things like school shootings, not the kinds of crises that happen when a student dies by suicide or a staff member dies by suicide.
Is there perhaps a fear that if you talk about it, you put that thought into somebody's head?
Absolutely. It's a huge fear, and it's one of the most pervasive myths about suicide, which is that if I ask you, are you thinking about killing yourself, that somehow that's going to make you want to kill yourself, which is totally not true. To the contrary, rather than increasing risk, it decreases risk.
But still, it seems like that hurdle of getting over the stigma is still there.
Well, it's enormous. It's the stigma. There's also a time and money thing. You can train staff for an hour once a year on identifying risk factors and warning signs, but then they go back to work, right? So this isn't something that can really just happen once and be effective. You have to commit to it.
Because I guess the thing is, nowadays with social media, word gets out in seconds, right?
It does.
My job has changed dramatically in 15 years since social media is so prevalent, because we could do a much more planned crisis response after a suicide, figure out exactly how we're going to tell them, make sure we contact the family first. Now we have no time. You know, we have to be prepared to respond immediately, or the kids are already talking amongst themselves, which is more dangerous, you know, again, because we don't know what they're saying and what truth there is. So it really has changed the game.
You know, one of the things that I'll say is that I think the suicide prevention community really sees social media and technology as neither inherently good nor bad. We talk about, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, you know, as possible ways of spreading bad information. But there are also apps out there that can help people create safety plans. There are apps that can help connect people instantly with others through either formal, you know, chat lines or whatever. Facebook has this thing where somebody can report a post and they get connected immediately to the chat lifeline. And so rather than shying away from social media and technology, I think we need to use it correctly and have active conversations about what that looks like and how we can do it best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Terry Urbacher is a professor of psychology at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Jonathan Singer is a professor of social work at Temple University. Together, they've written Suicide in Schools. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Concussions were a huge story in 2014. Everybody was talking about them. We talked a lot about concussions here on The Pulse, and the story is far from over. Each year, Americans suffer more than 2 million concussions, and experts think that 20% of those result in serious long-term injury. That's a lot of brain damage. Awareness levels of concussions as a problem have reached 21st century proportions. Diagnosing concussions, though, is still very much a 20th century affair. But a new blood test being developed right here in Philadelphia could change that. Regular Pulse contributor Avir Mitra, a fourth-year medical student at Drexel, has the story.
So I think we get it. Concussions are a huge deal. But here's the thing, how do you know for sure if you've got one? The things we associate with concussions, blacking out or seeing stars, they only happen in a fraction of cases, and you can't feel your brain cells dying. So I wanted to find out exactly how we go about diagnosing this condition. I spoke with Dr. Douglas Smith, director of the Center for Brain Injury and Repair at the University of Pennsylvania, who walked me through the process. As I found out, it's still a rather primitive ordeal.
So currently what we call a sideline type of test, you would have taken a baseline test at some point.
So if you were a person at high risk for concussion, like an athlete or soldier, you would have taken a test before anything happened, usually consisting of a few simple questions.
And these tests often look at things like what we call processing speed, how quickly you can think, or memory, you know, whether you can retain something that was just told to you.
And then if you get hit, you take the test again.
When you take the test again, your new score is going to be compared to that.
If you performed worse than your baseline...
All right, go to the emergency room, if that even happened. And you go to the emergency room, and even currently, you're basically being watched.
Considering the fact that we all agree concussions are a major public health concern, it's amazing that we're still relying on coaches to diagnose them using pretty primitive tools. I mean, this is all so subjective. And most of us haven't even had a baseline test in the first place. But even if you did...
They could be manipulated by the individuals or interpreted in varying ways by those giving the test.
That's Dr. Robert Simon. He's Dr. Smith's colleague and a research professor of neurosurgery at Penn.
There's clear opportunity for an objective and quantitative measure that takes the decision-making out of the hand of the athlete and the trainer and the coaching staff.
Is there a better way to diagnose concussions? Is there a better way to tell who will end up in the 20% with long-term damage and who will be just fine? Dr. Simon and Dr. Smith believe the answer just might be a protein they've discovered.
A protein that we call SNTF.
That's short for calpain-cleaved alpha-2 spectrum N-terminal fragment. Let's just go with SNTF. How could this tiny protein potentially help diagnose millions of concussion sufferers per year? Well, to understand that, we have to understand what SNTF actually is.
It's a fragment of a protein that is normally a part of the structural support of the axon.
See, your brain is made up of nerve fibers, and there are proteins that create the structural support inside those nerve fibers. So if the nerve fiber is a tent, these proteins are the tent poles. When you get a concussion and your brain bangs around the inside of your skull, the nerve fiber gets damaged and those structural proteins get broken. They literally break in half. The tent collapses and dies, and that broken half tent pole, that's SNTF.
This structural protein gets cleaved in half, and one of the halves of this protein that's not normally found in axons suddenly starts to accumulate within axons.
And so this cellular rubble, all those broken tent poles, start to pile up in the brain as nerve fibers collapse and die. It's a strange process that continues long after the moment of injury and is kind of kept going by certain enzymes that run amok inside the cell. But regardless, once the levels get high enough, SNTF starts leaking into the bloodstream.
And that's the protein that we find it becomes measurably increased in the blood.
And the good thing about a protein that leaks into the blood is that it can be measured. In other words, SNTF could be the first objective blood test for brain injury. Here's Dr. Smith again.
If we see the proteins that should be in those axons appear in the blood, that means those axons died.
In 2013, they tested the concept on patients coming into the emergency department after head injuries, and their results were promising. In 2014, they collaborated with Swedish researchers who had access to some pretty awesome research subjects.
All 288 players in the top professional ice hockey league in Sweden agreed to participate in this study.
They measured SNTF levels in the players before the season began. Then they took serial measurements of SNTF if and when any player got hit during the season. And amazingly, they found that SNTF levels did in fact correlate with concussion severity.
Players who suffered a concussion and had their post-concussion symptoms resolved within a few days had no difference in their blood levels of SNTF, but for that subset of players that had persisting post-concussion symptoms that required that they be withheld from play for 6 days or longer, they had measurable, statistically significant blood elevations in SNTF.
In other words, the test was able to distinguish between bad concussions and not so bad concussions.
And so SNTF blood levels were a prognostic marker, in that within hours of a player suffering a concussion, their blood levels of SNTF could be used to predict which of those concussed hockey players were going to go on to suffer long-term post-concussion symptoms.
More brain damage, more SNTF leaking out. It's a simple concept, but the implications are huge.
It's an admittedly small study, but it's the first evidence that a marker could be measured in the bloodstream on the day of a concussion that could distinguish between those individuals who are going to be okay after their concussion and those who are not.
Right now, they're the only lab capable of measuring SNTF, but Dr. Simon has patented the test and is in the process of developing it. But even so, there's still a lot of work to be done, because the fact is, even if we do diagnose a concussion, we still don't have any great treatment for it.
Exactly how to rehabilitate somebody is something that's never been defined in well-controlled clinical trials.
But Simon's hope is that an objective test like SNTF could help researchers investigate new treatment strategies. And to be fair, there are ongoing studies looking at other blood markers, as well as better imaging that would allow doctors to actually see concussion damage. So regardless of which method ends up on top, the race is certainly on to find a 21st century measure for a 21st century injury. For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
Coming up on The Pulse, we eavesdrop on some moving stories usually shared in a top-secret setting.
They call these, you know, recovery support group meetings, you know, the rooms. Like, oh, I heard it in the rooms. It's like this, like, hush-hush language, I guess, that we have.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to help fit your budget. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Medicaid doesn't pay enough. For years, that's been a complaint coming from a lot of doctors. And in response, the Affordable Care Act bumped up payments. And now there's some evidence that this temporary pay raise made it easier for people to book an appointment with a doctor. Tanya English reports.
The researchers hired secret shoppers to pose as Medicaid patients.
And what they did is essentially said, I just moved into town and I'm looking to get a primary care doctor. Can I get an appointment?
University of Pennsylvania health economist Dan Polsky led the survey of doctor's offices in 10 states. Early on, the secret shoppers were able to book an appointment about 58% of the time. After the pay raise, their success was 66%. Polsky says that change made his jaw drop.
What I make of that number is that doctors responded. They said, gee, you know, I should see more patients in my panel that have Medicaid. It seems worth it to me now.
In Pennsylvania and New Jersey, the Medicaid fee increase was steep, more than 80% higher for a 30-minute doctor's visit. Traditionally, Medicaid has been the federal health program for the very poor and the disabled. Under the Affordable Care Act, some states expanded the program to give health coverage to millions of others. But from the start, there were big worries that doctors wouldn't be willing to see the newly insured. The pay boost was designed to entice primary care physicians to take on more Medicaid patients.
The real problem with all of these things is the idea that I'm only about money. All the doctors care about is money. The whole idea that you can incentivize or disincentivize us based on money, it's not true.
Family physician Lucy Hornstein has a solo practice in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, just northwest of Philadelphia. She opted out of the Medicaid program years ago and says the pay raise did not entice her.
It just became way too many hoops to jump through for way too little payment. And for doctors, professionals in general, what we respond to is autonomy. We do the right thing because that's what we do.
The Medicaid pay bump was only temporary. After 2 years, rates dropped again at the beginning of 2015. Researcher Dan Polsky says now it's up to policymakers to decide if fees should be boosted permanently.
Now, if they're going to bump up and down, you may just hold off because that's a risky area to put your efforts.
The new study is just one lens to figure out if money is motivation enough to get more doctors to open their door to more Medicaid patients. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Imagine you're 28 years old and a totally healthy guy. For a few nights, you wake up in a cold sweat, you feel generally lousy and have some respiratory issues. No big deal, right? But you decide to get it checked out. Then a nightmare begins.
A small spot on my lung, and the biopsy showed that it was cancerous. Found out it was in my right shoulder and also in my lower back. After the radiation, it was just all over my chest. It just had gone both lungs, and it was just all over the place, and we were just completely floored. It actually got worse. It got pretty bad at that point in time, so...
Philadelphian Mark Kukler has been battling lung cancer for 3 years. He's 31 now. He's back on chemo, trying to keep the spread of cancer in his body at bay. He and his wife Rachel got married a year ago in the midst of all of this cancer chaos. In this edition of our series Patient Files, they talk about how they deal with all of the adversity as a couple and whether they ever think about prognosis.
It's not something we typically talk about to our doctors because we know that, you know, a lot of people will come in and ask, you know, how many years do I have? How long do I have to live? And I don't want to ask that really because nobody really knows because there's so many drugs out there. There's so many things that can do certain things, but you never know how that person's body's going to react to it. I don't know how my body's going to react. The doctor doesn't know that either, so... It's just it's a tough question to ask and even answer as a doctor themselves. So we kind of try to stay away from that and just try to take a day at a time. And whatever's working for us right now, we just be thankful for that, you know.
You say we with everything.
I always do. I always include Rach because she's always there right next to me, so.
We just try and do what we can on the days that he's feeling well. And that could be something as cheesy as walking through Target and just being normal and shopping, you know. But those are little milestones that, you know, for a few months there, I mean, he couldn't even get up to get a glass of water without help, you know. So I take the fact that he wants to go to the food stores like date night. We're just celebrating these little victories that we have. We're fortunate that we have a great support system through family and friends, and they're very understanding. And a number of friends will say, hey, we want to come over and have pizza night and, like, just hang out at the house with you guys and not go out, you know, because going out for him can be challenging. His energy level is greatly reduced over the past, I would say, 6 months. It's gotten a little bit lower. So he's been using an assisted wheelchair, occasionally using oxygen. It's not easy, but, you know, we try and do what we can with the good days. And, you know, when he has his bad days, I say, you know what? You can have a bad day today, but tomorrow you're going to have a good day.
Oh, absolutely. There's, you know, Rach mentions, you know, tough days that I have. And, you know, those are my tough days, is when, you know, I feel like I don't want to do anything else, you know. And she's always there to pick me up and, you know, vice versa. If she's having a bad day, I'll be there to pick her up. But yeah, those are the types of bad days that we have. You know, I could be feeling bad, you know, as far as, you know, my body not feeling great. I don't consider those bad days in my mind. When I have a bad day mentally, that's when I have a really bad day. Just how tough it is, you know, how much I have to put up with every day, how much she has to put up with.
He had a lot of those this past year. We had a lot of difficult conversations that I think no 30-year-old couple should have. If this is the if this is it, you know, and if you have 6 months left, how do you want that to look? You know, what can we do to make this the best possible last 6 months anybody's ever had? You know, and it pains me because he's like, you know, I don't want to go jump out of an airplane. I don't want to go, you know, on some exotic vacation. He's like, For me, I just wanted to live a normal life, you know, with you. We're not the typical 30-year-old couple, but I think the love that we have for each other is maybe greater than any other 30-year-old couple that you might see, because I think we've kind of learned, you know, what's really important in life. And it is these little milestones and not having silly arguments and enjoying every single moment that you get to wake up next to the person that you love, and it's tough.
Since 2012, Rachel and Mark Kukler have raised over $100,000 for lung cancer research by participating in the Philadelphia Free to Breathe Walk with their team, Miles for Mark. They want to help fund research, but also raise awareness that lung cancer is not just a smoking-related disease. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. If you or a loved one have struggled with addiction, you'll know what I mean when I say the rooms. The rooms are shorthand for recovery meetings like 12-step programs, church basements, community spaces, daycares, or even kitchens. Millions of people have entered these rooms for support to share their stories, but the stories usually stay behind closed doors. Even the location is a secret. That's part of the tradition and code, and there are many reasons for that. Alana Gordon brings us the story of one woman who has been walking a fine line, bringing some of these stories out of the room, so to speak, and into the public sphere. Stories like her own.
The room has folding chairs. Coffee is brewing.
And I got a lot of support there.
The room is raw.
There's so many stories.
The room is open to anyone, but the room is anonymous. Okay, let's step out.
My name is Jillian Bauer. I am one of the 23 million people in the U.S. that is living in recovery.
Bauer is 31. She teaches journalism, she's a photographer, and she's an alcoholic.
My sobriety date is March 24th, 2013.
Bauer gives a lot of credit to the inspiration in those rooms, but it took her a long time to walk in because it took her a long time to see herself as having a problem. She didn't realize that in the rooms,
there were a lot of people like me and not the stereotype that I had in my mind of what, you know, an addict or an alcoholic is.
But until she attended, that all seemed hidden. So she decided to start the Rooms Project.
I got sober July 9th, 2009. What happened is that, you know, I hit the bottom.
I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia,
in the beginning,
in a lovely neighborhood, alcohol. In a lovely house.
The Rooms Project is a photo and audio story series on people who are living in recovery from alcoholism and addiction.
It took a really slow progression until it got to like this tipping point.
I was waitressing at a restaurant and somebody offered me.
Bauer has featured about 30 volunteers so far. For each, she includes a portrait and a non-narrated audio piece that came from her interviewing them about their addiction.
And I was in the program and, you know, forced to actually go to these meetings, and I hated every bit of it.
I said, here I am. What actually happened is this is what I'm doing right now.
So it's essentially one addict or alcoholic telling their story to another addict and alcoholic the same way that they would tell their story at a meeting or to somebody who's new and curious about recovery.
It takes usually like one person in a certain area to really allow me to know that I'm capable of more than maybe I thought that
the
I was.
The beginning was rough, like it always is, right? Like, so you feel
up,
like crap,
I
you don't understand, there's all these people that
jumped
are
right
happy,
in to the
them.
Work.
And I was so scared.
I'm just really truly doing it one day at a time.
Bauer says for her, alcoholism took the form of a double life. She drank a ton on the weekends. During the week, she had a full-time job.
At night, I was teaching, you know, 2 to 3 courses at, like, a pretty big university. And I was able to, like, run my own photography company on the side. It was insane.
Bauer says a turning point was realizing that she was obsessing about drinking even when she wasn't.
So Mondays, I would be, you know, Googling stuff like, am I an alcoholic? Am I an addict? I'm never going to drink again. I have so much anxiety. And then Tuesday would roll around and it would be this, okay, well, I think I just have a problem drinking, so I have to, like, moderate my drinking. Then Wednesday would roll
around. And by the weekend?
This was killer. The entire time that I would be drinking, I was either obsessing over whether or not I should have another drink or if I should have had the drink that I had before the one that I'm drinking.
Bauer reached out to an acquaintance, someone in her social circle she knew through Facebook, someone she noticed posting funny, honest updates about being in recovery, not the kind of person she'd imagined in the rooms. He told Bauer he'd been waiting for her to contact him.
Which was shocking because I thought I had this like beautiful double life set up where everybody thought everything was perfect. And they said, you need to go to a meeting and you need to put your hand up at that meeting. And that's what I did.
In all of Bauer's portraits, she has people sit in a folding chair, the same way they would be sitting while listening or telling a story in the rooms. Except they're not in the rooms. They're in their own environment, maybe their bedroom or outside.
You know, I used to never be able to run without music, and now I could come out here and just be with my dog or be by myself. And
I had a girl contact me who wanted to meet at the Wissahickon because she's a runner.
And then I got arrested. And,
like, she was an addict who was in jail. And is now a marathon runner. That's insanely inspirational to me. And, you know, she says, my mom still gets a kick out of the fact that I'm a runner, but now my parents actually brag about it.
And they're like, oh, yeah, my daughter's training for a marathon, blah, blah. And I think, like, it's goofy, and I tell them to stop it. But then I realize, you know, not so long ago, if somebody asked about their daughter was in state prison.
Bauer's photos and audio stories make a lot of references to the rooms. It can feel promotional, though many members have gone out of their way to ask that no program be mentioned by name. Anonymity is a heated, sensitive part of the recovery community. But this hasn't dissuaded Bauer.
I'm trying to respect everybody's opinions. I'm obviously going to continue to pursue this regardless.
Bauer is still part of this community. And she doesn't know if she had seen these portraits or heard these stories while she was in active addiction, if she would have made it to the rooms sooner.
I'm not sure. But what I do know is that since I've posted the stories that I've had online, I've had, like, tons of people reach out to me to say that they have a problem, that they need to get help, or, hey, I'm also in recovery and I didn't know that you were in recovery. So we're able to like connect on that point.
And at least for her, meeting more and more people and hearing their stories through this project has expanded her own room and recovery space as she continues to work through her addiction. It's been nearly 2 years since she's had a drink. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
We have audio and photos from the Rooms Project on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Brookman. Avery Brookins is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your questions, your feedback, your story ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.